chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, what is the best way to deal with the inevitable health problems that older people face, older people like me? And the answer, I think, is to talk to Dr. Norton Hadler, who's professor of medicine and microbiology and immunology at the University of North Carolina Medical School. Or, if you can't get a hold of him because he's pretty busy, you can read his book, Growing Old and Living Well in an Overtreated Society.
That's the subtitle, D.G. It's Rethinking Aging.
Rethinking Aging. That's exactly right. I got. Thank you. First correction. The title of the book is Rethinking Aging. And what do you mean? What is rethink? What do you? What, why are we? Why do we need to rethink aging?
Two things have happened in my lifetime, neither are sufficiently celebrated. The first thing that's happened is my generation, which the economists call the traditionalists, is the first generation ever to hit age 60 and rationally ask, what do I want to do with the next 25 years? My father's generation, most...
The next 20 years?
25 years.
25 years, yes, you to 85?
That's right, although it would be irrational to ask, what do I want to do with the next 30 years? And what's happened to longevity curves are fascinating. The likelihood of us arriving as octogenarians at a ripe old age has increased dramatically, mainly after World War II. But the likelihood of our becoming nonagenarians has not...
Nono meaning 90-year-olds.
90-year-olds has not increased dramatically. In fact, it's barely budged. And the way these curves are drawn, the mathematics involved, is difficult such that we can't be quite sure how long a particular birth cohort will live until they're long dead.
Right.
And then you look back and you know.
But the trends are that we're probably going to make 80, but not... 90.
The ideal longevity curve has us in a resource advantage world. Let me point out that everything you and I are going to talk about relates to the resource advantaged world, the resource disadvantaged world. And one way to think about that, the countries where it's not safe to drink the water, those countries have longevity curves that look like ours did a century ago. So everything we're talking about has happened in the resource advantage world through the course of the 20th century, and we can draw idealized curves. The ideal curve would have no infant mortality, have everybody living till age 85, and dying on that birthday, plus or minus some percentage, and not a very wide variation in that ideal longevity curve. And about 10 years ago, the Japanese birth cohorts were approaching the ideal curve. In fact, we lag a number of countries, a couple of dozen countries, in making it there. And as we'll talk as the hour goes on, there are reasons for that that we understand. There are also reasons why we would predict that the Japanese curves are not as good as they once were. But for us, we need to celebrate this. It's a very different mindset. A couple of generations ago, 60, 65 was old. Now 60 is a life passage for a goodly percentage of the population, similar to age 30. What do I want to do next? Furthermore, for the traditionalists, there's not all, and we've learned how tenuous it is, but there is a fair amount of freedom for a significant percentage of my birth cohort of the traditionalist generation. It's not so clear about the boomers, and we have very little information right now that's worthwhile in terms of predicting what will happen to Generation X and Y when they approach a ripe old age. But we certainly can speak to my generation, the traditionalists, people who are older than the boomers.
The upside that you point out is that the curves show that your cohort, my cohort, are likely to live much longer than people would have 50 or 100 years ago. Now, are there downsides to this development, or is it all upside happy development that I'm really going to get to live closer to the full potential of my body's original life? Life measurement or life expectation?
There are stumbling blocks. There are subsets in the population that are at greater risk of not making it to be an octogenarian. And there is a very important downside. It's not that we can eliminate fear of dying. I think fear of dying is about as human a predicament as ever and will never be eliminated, and is loaded with uncertainty and demands that we each have coping skills with the prospect. So it's not that you won't die. You will die. The death rate is one per person. But for the first time ever, we can sort of speak a little bit about the context of you will die. You should be able to think through living fully until you're an octogenarian. That ought to be part of what we think about when we hit age 60. And that notion has to be bolstered because you must confront the most extraordinary, egregious medicalization of the aging population that the world has ever seen.
Well, now let me interrupt you, because it looks to me like, on the surface at least, that is a part of this ability to live longer. We also have at our service a whole cadre of physicians, doctors, other medical people who are willing to serve us, to help us attack the various ailments that come up as we get old. And we have a whole bunch of new pills and medicines and drugs that are directed at taking care of some of these things that aren't as good about being old.
Yeah, like most Americans, you, as I said, are enjoying an absolutely extraordinary moment of medicalization. When we look at what is it that's likely to deprive you of a ripe old age at 85, only about 20% of the hazards have anything to do with medicine and biomedicine. About 80% of the hazards live in the context in which you live, your community, and we will talk about how difficult it is to define context, but we're much closer to defining context than we were 20 years ago. So there is something that medicine has to offer, but number one, it's not traumatic. Number two, there's a very important take-home message in those longevity curves. I actually don't care what kills me when I'm 85. I don't even care how many diseases I have when I'm 85. I don't care which one is the winner. I care about the when I die, and I care about what the journey was like. So if we're talking about octogenarians, first of all, nobody can save your life. Nobody can save your life. They can help you, with context and medicine, arrive at a ripe old age. That's the first thing you've got to understand. The second thing is, whenever you hear about, can we avoid death from this disease or that disease, the answer is, when is it likely to kill me? And if it's not likely to kill me before I'm an octogenarian, I'm not sure I care about it. And that's very different from what you're hearing. Your hearing is, I want to save your life from this condition. I want to save your life from that condition. And what you need to ask is, if you save my life from that condition, will I die at the same time from another? For example, you'll hear that 33,000 men will die of prostate cancer this year. Well, you've got to ask when. It turns out most of them will die when they're octogenarians. And that's such a powerful statement that I can tell you that if we removed all the prostates, breasts, colons, ovaries from everybody who's age 60, we will spare a few outliers, death before their time. But for the population age 60, we're not going to change their date of death as a population. So there are two very important issues that you have to reframe. And that's what this book is trying to do, is to reframe them. One is that we can't not die, that if the context is correct and a few parts that we talk about that medicine has to offer, if you can make it to 85, that's terrific. And going to great lengths to change the diagnosis on your death certificate is irrational.
Let me just hold on to that point just for a minute. I'll try not to get us off track, but what you're saying is that if you get to 85, you should be thankful, particularly if you've had a good, healthy life, and then maybe relax about knowing that it's inevitable in the next 5 or 6 or 10 years, there will be one of these conditions or diseases, or your body will just kind of give out. And don't spend the rest of that short period of life worrying about which one and taking a bunch of medicines and having surgeries. Is that what your message is?
In part. Relax is a difficult statement. As I said, fear of death is part of the human predicament. No one relaxes with this notion. Another fear is of frailty, which I think we need to reframe as a society, because frailty is a time of life also with challenges and difficulties. And there's a chapter on frailty in the book that talks in that tone. There's a chapter on decrepitude, the musculoskeletal challenges that come with making it to 85, which are essentially ubiquitous and which need to be understood. There's nothing about this that's trivializing. It's much more reframing it so that we're not making choices that are not likely to really benefit us. So at 85, first of all, I have no idea when people will die, nor does any one of us want to know. So if you make it to 85, the way I teach this is in the resource advantage world, if you make it to 85, you're off warranty. And if you make it to 90 feeling terrific, more power to you. You're really lucky. By the way, that didn't come from mother or father. This is being old is a statistical outlier. We don't understand what predisposes to old. And there will be the occasional person who is absolutely vibrant at 100. But most people who are 90 are far from vibrant, and they represent a tiny percentage of the population. This is a very big population, so a tiny percentage is a lot of people. And we need to rethink this time of life, because we made a whole bunch of mistakes in the 60s and 70s that we're paying the price of now. In the 60s and 70s, we developed the nursing home.
Let's take a break and talk about those mistakes in the 60s. We're visiting with Dr. Norton Hadler in the context of his latest book, Rethinking Aging. He and I will be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about Dr. Norton Hadler's latest book, Rethinking Aging. And before the break, you were talking about some mistakes that were made in the 60s in terms of the topic we've been talking about.
Yeah, the federal underpinnings of the nursing home movement come into being in the 60s, and sort of actually preceding the Medicare events. And there were lots of good ideas involved in the nursing home movement. There were lots of wonderful ideas involved in the Medicare event. A lot of them were in the 60s, where the conversation we've just had about the likelihood of living to 85 but not to 90 was neither understood nor true. If you were an octogenarian in the 1960, you were an outlier.
A statistical outlier.
That's right. So the nursing home movement was a convenience for an aged population that was frail and decrepit and dying alone and impoverished at home. That was the argument for both the nursing home movement and for the Medicare legislation. There were a tremendous percentage of Americans who were living a very tortured fate in their last years. Well, we've already discussed what's happened to longevity curves, and we need to celebrate what's happened to longevity curves. This is really remarkable. It is the notion of aging has to be totally reframed, including the notion of warehousing those people in the last years of their life. That has to be reframed too, including the notions that we have to partition and segment the care of the elderly, that we have to take the wealthy old aging population and put it behind gates and fences, and we have to have nursing homes.
Well, you talked about the good. What are the mistakes? What were the mistakes?
We have inherited this warehousing notion, and we need to rethink it. We need to understand.
So the notion of nursing homes, which you're characterizing sort of as warehouses, has worked out not to be the right step that we took in the 60s.
It turns out to be inappropriate today, very difficult to manage today. The second most regulated industry in America is the nursing home industry, right behind the nuclear energy industry.
Is that right?
It is. It is hard to avoid abuses. It is hard in our society not to say that the nursing home is a fate as opposed to an asset.
It's turned out to be a big moneymaker for some people, hasn't it?
I discuss that in the book, and the tradition of turning nursing homes and other aspects into profitability also has its roots in the 60s, and it is a whole set of issues. I mean, we in America are not hobbled by the fact that we don't put a tremendous amount of our largesse into the care of the aging population. We're hobbled because most of the money doesn't go for caring.
Where does it go?
Oh, for things that are unnecessary, for profitability, for a tremendous administrative overload, for a tremendous amount of abuse. That has nothing to do with.
For instance, just put that in context in terms of where do the funds, which are made available through various sources for nursing home care, you're saying that only a small percentage of it goes to actual care,
and
that
only a small percentage of the health so-called healthcare dollar goes to actual care in this country, meaning evidence supported beneficial interventions. The nursing home issue has to be reframed, and what do we mean by benefit? Who's really benefited?
I don't want to lead you or try to lead you where you don't want to go, but in terms of trying to get hold of the lots of money that we're spending on nursing homes and the care or on health-related expenses for older people, you're saying that, first of all, that there's a lot for administration. Secondly, I think, and I want to hold on to this for things that don't really benefit the person who's being cared for. And can you what are you talking about when you talk about those?
Well, they're Rethinking Aging, and the three other books I wrote before that are not into the politics or the money. The book I'm writing now, which is almost finished, is purely politics and money. So I'm going to answer your questions, but if you won't find the references in Rethinking
Aging. We'll have to
wait
to read in detail about this for your next book.
The book's called Citizen Patient, and it is essentially finished, but we're not going to release it until after the election, which unfortunately will not prove a solution to our health care dilemma. But let me just explain a couple of overviews for you. We expend approaching 17% of our GDP in something called health. That's twice what our nearest competitors in the resource-advantaged world, who have better longevity statistics than we do, spend. So there's a disconnect here. There's cognitive dissonance. We are spending a tremendous amount more, like two, in fact, three times what some countries are spending. And we're not even close to them in terms of the health of our population with the very simple measure of how long do you live? There are other measures, too, but that's the one that nobody is going to argue about.
Well, that's one that you can really measure and not argue about.
Others. The number of procedures we do, the number of high-ticket items we do, the expense of drugs on the average cost 50 to 60 to 70% more in our country than they do in our sister countries who are similarly resource advantaged, who have better longevity, and the use of pills that are Me Too agents and new agents and have no demonstrable or demonstrated efficacy of clinical significance is part of the marketing here. So it's very easy actually to say to demonstrate to anyone who's interested that there's something wrong here. And it's not something wrong in Denmark. It's something wrong here. We have outcomes that we should not be proud of compared to other resource-advantaged countries, and we spend 2 to 3 times the amount of money.
All right, now again, on outcomes, I want to just get back, because the one outcome that we can agree on, apparently, is longevity. But you keep talking about outcomes, and what other are the outcomes that are not satisfactory in the United States?
That's the only one we've talked about. We've talked about some of the process variables. I mean, when we introduced this session, I said there are two things that we need to be celebrating, and that I celebrate in Rethinking Aging. The other one I celebrate in all four of the books that I've written on this topic. And that is very simply that for the first time in the history of the world, it is possible for a patient to go before a doctor and say, "Doc, how certain are you that what you're talking about will really advantage me?" And for a tremendous number of the things that we do in American medicine or in other countries, we have an informative science that would allow a substantive answer. Prior to the 1960s, by and large, the answer was, that's what we do. And I'm pretty sure it works. And this is called eminence-based medicine.
What is that?
Eminence, that you're talking to somebody who is really an authority. You still may be talking to really an authority. That's not the issue. In fact, you want to have a level of trust in this conversation. But it's no longer simply a matter of opinion. Because in a tremendous number of things that we do have been subjected to systematic study. And when you look at the data on a tremendous number of things we do, for example, stenting, there are 5 randomized controlled trials of stenting. That means people were or weren't stented, where they were compared with medical therapy, nothing interventional. And I got news for you, and these are 5 settings. Each one is a different setting, following the heart attack, continued pain after a heart attack, high likelihood of a heart attack. These are all the settings that are studied. Not a single life has been saved. It isn't even clear that a single heart attack has been saved. In fact, a lot of these procedures seem to cause heart attacks. And it isn't at all clear that anybody feels better for the procedure. The same thing, by the way, is true for coronary artery bypass grafts. Now,
you've had to confront this question 1,000 times, but we all know people who swear by their stent who say, it just changed my life. Because before I got tired climbing the stairs, and I was about to have a heart attack, or I did, and they put the stent in, and I'm just as good as new.
That's true, and that's why we do the studies. So there are 2 explanations. One is they would have been as good as new without it in the same period of time, because that's what the studies look like. Or they are individuals who are different from the individuals who were studied. And people like me would say to the second possibility, that may be true too. It is very hard to go through these procedures without feeling heroic for having done it. And we have a society that does what you just did. I know people who really, and they walk around, they tell you, I've got 2 stents, and you've got 3 stents, and we've got 4 stents. And it's part of the social construction of health. I'm not sure that's a wonderful social construction of health unless they're really better off for it. And if they are a particular subset that hasn't been studied, given the fact that we've studied so many subsets and you would do as well without the stent, well, I think it behooves the interventional community to find another subset and do another study before we spend a tremendous amount of our wealth.
So to put this in terms of the amount of money that we spend, and largely on folks in our older cohort, but not altogether. I mean, some young people as well. That basically, bottom line, the money spent on stents and the surgery that accompanies it is wasted money. Is that what you're saying?
You won't find that in Rethinking Aging. What you will find is a discussion of informed medical decision making, so that when you're facing the option of stenting or bypass graft, you know how to ask the telling questions. Do I want the risk? Do I think that this will really make it? How do you know? And if the interventionalist has to say to you, well, you know, I think you're probably different from all the studies, then you have to say,
yeah, but
well,
I mean,
how
you're,
different?
You're
I don't talk about dollars. I told you that in
this
book.
I talk about how you
make a decision.
You have said, if you want to make the point, I want you to make it. If you want to back away from it, I want you to back away from it. But is it wasted money? Do the studies show, do the studies teach us that you rely on, having a stent put in is wasted money and a risk to you, in addition to the waste of money that's going to be a part of it?
There is no way I would let anybody put a stent into me or do a bypass.
Under
any circumstances
and
whatsoever.
Explain just in a little bit more detail. We know this, and I think your answer is going to be, well, the studies do not show any significant benefit in the large majority of cases for these procedures, and I'm not going to take the risk that accompanies them.
No, what the studies show is that I will do as well without the stent as with it. And what the studies show is that I will do better without the CABG than with it, the bypass graft. That's what the studies show.
So
and
it's fair for you to say that it's a mistake to have, I mean, what other answer can the informed physician give you or me when I ask, is this stent going to be?
I told you what they will say.
What will they say?
They will say, number one, I think we do it better. And number two, I think you're different from the kind of people that were in all these studies. And you need to put that into your decision tree, your personal decision tree. In this country, since it's paid for by Medicare and therefore by all of us, or your so-called private health insurance company, you don't get the personal sting. I can guarantee you, if there was an enormous copay, you would say, geez, I'll take my chances, because we're people, not because we are gamesmen or understand, because we're people. And we have such a extraordinary medicalized culture that to walk away from something high-tech, dramatic, dangerous, and potentially lethal is cowardice. So in our country, in order to be as great a man as Henry Kissinger, you need to have bypass grafts.
Well, let's take a quick break and come back. We'll continue our discussion with Dr. Norton Hadler about his new book, Rethinking Aging.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Dr. Norton Hadler is the author of many books and many papers. I think this is your fourth sort of book that us laymen can read and understand.
General audience,
Rethinking Aging.
Which I started writing about 10 years ago. The first of them came out in 2004. And the reason I started writing them is this level of conversation needs to go on in our country.
I'm interested in all of them. I've got a sore back today. And so your book about, you convinced me. I'm waiting it out because you persuaded me that sore backs are a human condition in most cases, and that if I'll have a little patience and get through it, that more than likely I'm going to be okay and have a better chance of being okay than if I go through a whole bunch of medicines and procedures. Is that and so?
And stabbed in the back, I take you through that. But you certainly have a better chance. It isn't clear that we can do anything for your low back that will increase the healing rate if this is what I call a regional backache,
right.
An otherwise perfectly well man. If I took your history, I would tell you whether or not I'm comfortable saying that you fit into
that category. Something in my history that would say this
I don't
is
like to miss metastatic prostate cancer or metastatic there are lots of causes of these, but for almost everybody it's what I call a regional backache.
It's a norm. It would be abnormal if you didn't have a sore back.
If you go a year without a backache, that's abnormal. And if you're treated in your experience to its natural history, which is one of it will get better, and which you will be treated to its natural history unless there are confounders, you will not even remember the last episode.
Oh, is that right?
We know that from diary studies.
Write it down if I want to remember the days.
We have studies where people are asked to write it down, and we know that the vast majority don't remember, even though it may have been. This is not necessarily trivial. You may have had a very difficult week or two or three where you had to be careful how you moved, and you had to think twice before you did things that you usually didn't think twice about. So it's not that this is trivial. And what will stop you from your natural history are sometimes the intensity of the pain, but more often confounders to coping. You're about to be downsized. I can guarantee that'll
then
do
you,
it.
Or then, these things
then in our culture, the way we think things through is my back is killing me. I'm about to be downsized. The reason I'm having trouble with coping with the notion of downsizing is my back is killing me, as opposed to the contrary, which is downsizing is an awful thing, and it'll make it hard for me to even cope with my backache. And we're loaded with this kind of interaction. A lot of it is socially constructed. It's the way we raise our children to think. And we need to reframe that, too. That's the book that came out called Stabbed in the Back, Before Rethinking Aging.
I want to move from my back condition, which is one which you've persuaded me is normal, not just for older people, but for all of us. But moving into rethinking aging, are there conditions like that I'd better get used to and not jump into some magic medical cure, but accommodate my life to these normal conditions for older people?
Yeah, well, first of all, I am a physician who's been practicing for a very, very long time, and I consider medicine a privilege to practice and a ministry, and no one should ever be afraid of going to their physician and saying, is this something I need to worry about? That's your right and responsibility as a person who's concerned about their health. There ought to be wise counsel. It should never, ever be paternalistic, maternalistic, tell me what to do. That's one of the things we need to celebrate.
Give me advice, but not direction.
Actually, that's more the notion that I'm the captain of this ship. I'm having some troubled waters here. I need a navigator. And the next part of that, I need a navigator, relates to the evidentiary basis of medicine, the fact that we're no longer simply guessing or listening to what someone else told us or what we learned from somebody who was august. We now have ways to answer your question, are you sure? How sure? And if it works, how much will it work? Mm-hmm. And if I don't do it, how worse off will I be? These are all perfectly reasonable questions.
A little checklist of questions like that.
They're not challenges anymore. Mm-hmm. This is the 21st century medical interaction. The 19th century was I doctor, you patient, I speak, you listen. That's done.
Let me move on to one of the things that seems to have an impact on us older people more, and that is the tendency to put on weight. And we're worried about weight in our society. We're worried about the pre-diabetes condition. You're not as worried as some of the rest of us are about weight, are you?
We're doing a marvelous job of medicalizing the aging process at multiple levels, including so-called cardiovascular risks. which is why you're hearing about weight and why you're hearing about get your hemoglobin A1C. In fact, most Americans, and certainly most aging Americans, know all their numbers. They walk around, they can tell you everything from their bone mineral density, their cholesterol, and they measure these things with great frequency. And it's the same set of questions. You know, you never ever want to know those numbers unless the numbers are accurate, they reflect an important disease, and we can do something about them. If they fail on any of those, why do you know your numbers? So the weight issue. Now, there is a social construction to weight. I mean, if you were thin 100 years ago, you were considered poor and sickly. Now, if you're not thin, you're considered poor and sickly. And you have to ask, what's the data for that? And there is a tremendous amount of information that speaks to the risk of your various BMIs, body mass index, your weight as a function of your height. And it is perfectly true in every single data set, you do not want to be very overweight, meaning morbidly obese, a BMI over 35. And you don't want to be itty-bitty, because a BMI under 18 and a half also correlates with not making it to 85 for some reason.
Too thin is really maybe your charts that you have in your book suggest that too thin might even be worse than too fat.
Well, thrown into too thin are some not only eating disorders, but people with wasting diseases. So the too thin...
Be careful about that.
And the morbidly obese tends to have, in those data sets, also eating disorder. The morbidly obese is a BMI over 35, and they have independent hazards for not making it to 85.
Well.
Important independent, like a handful of years at risk. And we've been teaching ever since the World Health Organization came out with their curves that normal is between 18 and a half and 25, and 25 to 30 is overweight, and 30 to 35 is obese, and over 35 is the kiss of
danger.
Death.
We need to take a break. We need to take a quick break.
Actually, anything wasn't normal was dangerous.
Quick break. We'll be back with Dr. Norton Hadler talking about some of the important things that he raises in his new book, Rethinking Aging. He and I will be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Dr. Norton Hadler. His new book is Rethinking Aging. And one of the things that you rethink in the book is weight. And we were right in the middle of a conversation. We had to take a break.
Yeah, we were talking about the standard teaching based on the World Health Organization that if you're overweight and obese, you're also at risk, not at the kind of risk you would be at morbidly obese. Well, there are now two very important studies, and there was a third. One, the first came from Australia, another from Canada, and one is ours. Although ours was withdrawn from the literature for reasons that I think are largely political. If you correct these hazard curves for socioeconomic status any way you measure it, then the risk of being overweight or obese disappears. The risk of being overweight or obese in our society is a surrogate measure for being in the lower quintiles of socioeconomic status.
So you're arguing that the fat poor people are more likely to die early because of the socioeconomic conditions than because of their
poor
weight condition.
Because of their weight, that's right. And they don't need to have the Coca-Cola removed from the schools in Arkansas. They need good jobs and English as a second language and an opportunity to move into the mainstream.
This is just so radical. I mean, you say it so calmly, but it's that's counter to everything that we're hearing from our health professionals now.
I never, ever write these books without displaying all the references and all the data. And I never, ever give an interview such as this without having ready recourse to the books that display it. This is not hidden. It's only hidden mostly and more in America, the influence of socioeconomic status. We don't talk about it much. They do in other countries with loud voices.
So because we're out of time, the best thing we could do public health-wise, according, and this, I'm putting words in your mouth, but I want you to correct me, is to address the socioeconomic conditions that afflict some people in American society, that if we take care of that, we take care of many of the things that keep that category of people from being on the same curve chart.
With the proviso, which I discuss and expand on at great length in Rethinking Aging and several other books, that socioeconomic status is not money. It has to do with community. It has to do with job security. It has to do with a lot more than just dollars. And so it has to do with the structure of society. And it's very easy to perturb. For example, longevity in Russia went down 10 years within 10 years of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And it had nothing to do with health adverse behaviors because they were maximum before the wall came down. It had to do with the structure of the society.
It's that our health conditions then, the negative health conditions, are in many of the negative aspects result because of the extra pressures that are on people who are at the lower level of society.
Well, we don't like our cages rattled. For example, one of the most lethal things that we can easily measure in a number of studies now is downsizing. It may do wonders for the stock market, but it does terrible things to the people who are downsized in the traditionalist and boomer generation. The X and Y may be totally used to it and consider it part of life, like another backache. Well, for the traditionalists, it is a very health adverse event.
As always in conversations with you, you raise more questions than we're ever able to answer, but such a provocative book and always a wonderful provocative conversation with you, Dr. Norton Hadler. Thanks for the book and for agreeing to spend some time with your Chapel Hill neighbors.
Thank you, D.G. It's a pleasure.
And thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, Who's Talking. I'll be back here before you know it.